What up, Primers? JC here. Can't get enough of Footy Prime the podcast? Why not head over to Footy Prime's YouTube? Head to youtube.com/footyprime for exclusive video content. Then make your way over to wearefootyprime.com for all things Footy Prime, including our official gear from Admiral and our One Ball Gin from Nickel 9 Distillery. And make sure to follow and subscribe across all platforms, from Twitter to Instagram to Facebook to TikTok. Footy Prime has got you covered for all things footy. Thanks so much for listening, and back to the show. You are now listening to Footy Prime, the podcast, hosted by Danny Dicchio, Craig Forrest, and James Sharman.
Well, hello there, and welcome back to Footy Prime. It's been a couple of weeks. I was away on vacation. These guys cannot do anything without me. So therefore, they took the week off.
You're like our wife.
I am. I'm the pod wife. Yep. James Sharman here with Craig Forrest, Danny Dicchio, and on keyboards, Dan Wong. Listen, we'll get to our topic of the week shortly, but we'd be remiss if we didn't briefly mention what happened yesterday and the tragic death of Kobe Bryant, a huge fan of all things football. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend I was a huge basketball fan, Kobe fan necessarily, but, you know, as a sports fan, you followed this guy. You obviously knew a lot about him. He was one of those few that transcended the sport, and it does feel like a punch to the gut for some reason, you know? I mean, like I said, I don't own his shirts, so I wouldn't necessarily have to watch him, but I respected him. But that was a tough day if you're a sports fan.
Yeah. I watched and watch a lot of NBA and have the utmost respect for him, and the utmost professional as well. And it's, you know, what was made it even worse, obviously, with his daughter Gigi on the flight as well, which is crushing, as well as all the other people, 9 people in total. There's a coach as well as his wife and daughter also on that flight. So just tragic, and it got worse as the day went on. It's a really, really sad story. And, you know, he had a football connection, Deitch. You know, yeah. We know he lived in Italy when he was young, when his dad played in the NBA and then moved over to Italy in the league there. So learned very well. I mean, Italian fluently. Milan fan.
Big AC Milan fan.
Yeah, Barcelona.
Really goes to show how cosmopolitan he was as well, you know. I mean, he moved over there at a young age. I think it was his dad, Joe, Craig, that moved across after playing the NBA, and I think he went on to France as well, but speaks a little bit of French, but fluent in Italian. They love him in Italy as well, so it was a big loss to the world of sports. It was a punch in the gut to everyone yesterday, just how it unraveled, and just goes to show you how short life is. And, you know, you kind of grab your kids yesterday and hold them really tightly, and there was all kinds of emotions going through everyone's heads yesterday, and it was just a very, very sad day to lose a legend, a real legend like that.
I was trying to think, you know, who would be the comparison in football, right? And I kept thinking it's almost David Beckham, in that, I mean, I think Kobe was a better ball player than Beckham was, a footballer. But he understood his brand. He transcended the sport, you know. He was a great player, not the best ever. You know, you could argue where he ranks, you know. I think Michael Grange said for him he was between 10 and 20. Others would say top 3 of all time, right?
Yeah.
But he understood his brand like Beckham did, and no matter whether you're a fan of the sport or not, you knew who Beckham was. You know who Beckham is. You knew who Kobe was as well. And it just shows that the power of sport, right? And, you know, we're sports fans, number one. Mm-hmm. And you can't not understand, you know, what he meant to his sport. But beyond that, you know, he's a smart guy. You know, he understood he worked it better than most.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think makes it so painful. It's so hard.
I think as well, we've all got children as well. And I go back to, for me, I don't fear death. I fear what I'm leaving behind. And I looked at what unraveled yesterday, and his children and his wife that I feel so sorry for, and the other people that were on the helicopter, and you kind of have a new outlook. Not a new outlook, but you just really kind of think about,
put things in perspective.
Yeah, what I have to do in my life. Don't worry about the small things. Just kind of get on with it, because you never know.
Michael Grange wrote a great column on Sportsnet.ca about this, and he talks about how we can all relate to it, because forget the helicopter, but he was just taking his kid to a game. We've all done that.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm. Not
very,
on a helicopter,
it's very relatable.
But
but break it down, it's relatable, because we've all done that, taking a kid to their practice, to their game, and then they don't come back, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a,
it's a really tough
horrendous.
Day. It was a tough day.
Yeah.
And our good friend Alex McKechnie at the Raptors, he was with Kobe in Los Angeles for 10 years or so. It was a hard day for all the basketball, but for Alex McKechnie, it was extremely tough. I was texting with him yesterday about it, and he's also got some dental surgery he has to go through today, so bad couple of days for,
no
for Alex.
Well, I mean, these players kept playing, right? You know, and the earlier game, and I guess the information was coming down during the game. Do you have anything similar when you heard about something profound just before a match? That
9/11.
9/11, yeah.
9/11, yeah. We were in Reading, and we had an FA Cup game against Reading with West Ham, and it had happened that afternoon, early, sort of around noon, I guess, of pre-match, and we still played the game that night, then every game was cancelled.
Yeah, I remember being in a hotel. I was at West Brom. I just signed for West Brom, and I kind of was still in the hotel. I hadn't found a house yet. My family was still down in London, and I was like, what's going on here? And it was everyone was kind of glued towards the TV, this somber kind of atmosphere. No matter how many thousands of miles away you were, everyone kind of felt it. Mm. I remember a similar kind of instance when Princess Diana died. I was in Genoa at the moment with Sampdoria, obviously being from London as well, and just the tragic accident that happened there. And my mum's a big royal as well. She loves the royals, and she loved Princess Diana. That was a tough one as well, not only for me, but just because of how much my mum really loved, and England loved Princess Diana. She was like the country's princess, not only the royal's princess. And it just shows you that life does go on, but with a heavy, heavy heart. And I think that the players that played yesterday, we saw a lot of outpouring of grief, but just the respect and what Kobe meant to different players, whether it be in tennis. I saw in the tennis final, Nadal yesterday, the two girls that played in the final as well, yeah. Writing stuff.
So Neymar,
all kinds. Neymar
celebrate with
after his celebration, pointing up with a 2-4. Mm-hmm. And just the players playing in the NBA yesterday. I'm sure a lot of them knew Kobe personally or watched Kobe. He was the guy that they looked up to.
I thought it was a classy thing that the Raptors and the Spurs did last night, running right out of the start of the gates, running 24-second violations, which I thought was fantastic.
Brilliantly Pop done a really good thing as well, because the Raptors went first, didn't they?
The Raptors went first,
And then he kind
of... What I understand from Alex was that it was Nurse's decision. He talked to Pop, the coach of Spurs, about doing this, and both of them ran the 24-second violation, which I thought was a really classy...
I'm surprised, though, Craig. Like, you know, in football, we have the one-minute silence. Why did they not do that in the NBA? Is there a reason for it? Is it because of TV or stuff like? Because for me, that was the perfect example yesterday for that game, the Raptors versus the Spurs. Mm-hmm. Everyone was feeling emotional in the stadium. Everyone, there was shouts of Kobe within the stadium as well.
That's a good question. I don't know why. Yeah,
do they do it in other sports?
It's
I'm not too sure.
It's a huge thing in European sports, isn't it? Yeah.
No, I think it had to do with the fact that his number was 24 and the shot clock was 24.
But there was no minute silence before the game.
That was kind of it replaced it.
Right.
Right? Like the 24-second clock thing replaced the moment of silence.
Okay.
So they took the ball, they held the ball, and then they gave it to the other team, so it ended up being a minute of silence.
Right. Yeah. I thought the NBA would kind of sanction something to say that all games there's going to be a minute silence before the start today, just not only for the players but for the fans to show their appreciation.
Or even a minute's applause.
Applause, exactly.
I actually like that.
Yeah. I prefer that as well. You're right.
But the fact that there was such grief across so many different sports is what struck me. Often you get, you know, a tragic death in a sport, and within that sport, you feel it, you see it, but other sports don't react.
Yeah.
But like you said, be it tennis, be it football, be it whatever it is, people are saying, man, this guy meant so much to me.
Yeah. The NBA is a big league worldwide. It's really, really popular. And I know amongst all the football players in England that I played with and foreigners that I played with, all really liked it and followed it very closely.
We, obviously, Cabby was quite tight with Kobe.
Yeah.
Back in the day, and back at the Score and the Footy Show, we actually got Kobe through Cabby to give us a promo once, and it was like, I forget what he said now. I'm Kobe Bryant, and when I'm in Canada, I watch the Footy Show or something. And it gave us holy crap, that's amazing. Thanks, Cabby.
I saw Kobe's stuff so cool. yesterday. You got pretty emotional.
He did,
didn't
yeah.
He?
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. In many ways, Kobe, I wouldn't say built Kobe's career per se, but he certainly helped it, right? You work with Kobe a lot.
Yeah, so the crazy thing, and I know Sharms is going to... It took Kobe probably like 5 to 8 months of visiting, like seeing Kobe
breaking
him down, because he thought he was a clown, I think. Yeah. It looked like, hey, F off, I'm busy.
Who is this guy?
Yeah, exactly. And then... Slowly but surely, Kobe, like, kudos to him, to get into a place where he goes, look, I'm doing a job, I'm not making fun of anybody, but we're here to show the fun of television and sports, and this is what, and they ended up, like, you saw pictures of them, and I was just like, geez, you can tell how close they were, because he was, like, putting them in headlocks, and now you're having fun.
Yeah.
And for Kobe, it always seemed like he did have that arm's length, you know, whenever they talk about Kobe with the Lakers, he was didn't always go, hey, I'm your best friend, but I'm the way we're going to win championships and be the best professional. Mm. I'm going to keep everyone a little bit at arm's length.
Well, you got to think he's going to keep people at arm's length out of just defense almost, you know, like, you know, people want a piece of him. Everybody wants a piece of him.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to sort of be somewhat defensive about, you know, who you're dealing with. And people are trying to use you as well to further their own careers and sort of thing. So, yeah, it would take some time, certainly, to
Also lived a different lifestyle. The guy grew up in Italy and then came over to play high school, you know, at that prep school.
Well, they teach that. He's quite worldly, you know.
Intelligent guy, right? You hear him speak.
Yeah.
You know, and in the great wide world of sports, it's not often you get that.
Oscar winner. He won an Oscar for his documentary.
Short film, right?
Precisely, right,
A bigger life.
He almost just begun, right? And that's the part of the tragedy, you know? Yeah. This is not a guy that's going to retire quietly. You know, it's not Kobe. But I think, was it this podcast we spoke about the fact that there's only a handful of guys who you know globally by their first name, or they have a brand. Oh, it's Kobe.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Pele.
Mm.
Muhammad Ali, obviously, right? Some of that transcended the sports. There aren't many, but I think we debated, was it this podcast? And does Kobe fit into that? And I think yesterday proved that he does.
Yeah. Well, it is now this podcast.
Yeah, it is now, yeah. I'm pretty sure it was, though. I mean, guys, my memories are so bad, right? We've been doing this for so long now. But, very, very sad day for all the sport. And I'm sure he'll be remembered appropriately in the coming days and weeks. Let's get to the topic at hand, shall we? Of course, it's football. And today, we've decided to pick out, due to the fact that MLS and the Canadian Premier League are right now beginning their pre-seasons, or in the midst of their pre-seasons, let's talk about pre-seasons today, fellas.
Mm-hmm.
And just what they were like for you both. Did you enjoy them? Did you hate them? So let's start by going way, way back to your first pre-season professionally. Now, I'll start with you, Craig, right? So you... this young Canadian kid going to Ipswich, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. Do you remember your first preseason?
I do, and it was hard. Oh, jeez, it was so hard. Being 16 years of age and being 6'5", I was a little behind. My body wasn't catching up to itself.
Voice hadn't broken yet.
Yeah, hardly. And then you're running around, and honestly, running was just, I could not, long-distance running, I couldn't do it. I just, like, struggled. I couldn't figure, like, brutal, absolutely brutal. So it was difficult. But the only good thing is being a goalkeeper, that wasn't always a bad thing. And now I think more than ever, it's specific training.
Yeah.
Not that back in the day, they used to throw the goalkeepers into the long distance. Like, what do I have to go run 15 kilometers for?
Was it just about fitness back in those days? Like, get fit in preseason as opposed to now you better be fit for preseason?
I really believe it was a mental thing as well back in those days. Listen, the first day of preseason was not only the worst because you knew you was going to be doing some physical activity that was going to make you throw up. But it was also your last day of freedom of summer, where most people, like on the radio, they're all celebrating, yeah, it's the first day of summer. We knew that it was going to be the first day of preseason. Yeah. So,
and book your holidays.
If
you're ever going to go to England, book it when there's preseason. No, find out when the football team's got preseason, because it's always 35 degrees for those 2 weeks.
Yeah, always.
Always. The rest of the time it's freezing.
It was always scorcho in them 2 weeks. But as you just said there, long gone are the days where we used to come back for pre-season, and there was a couple of boys where you go, oh, ooh, all right, Johnny, you had a good couple of weeks here, haven't you?
Put a few pounds
on. Piled on a few pounds, and he'd be like, yeah, but we've got 4 weeks, I'm going to burn it off. No chance that could happen now. You've got players that are coming in 2-3 weeks prior, prepared, guys that have got their own kind of strength and conditioning, guys that they're working with. But if you came in, if you come in underprepared or overweight now, not only are you getting fined or ostracized by your teammates and staff.
You would be? So your teammates would say, come on, man.
Oh, yeah,
like,
for sure.
You're letting us down here. Because the rumor was Eden Hazard arrived at Real Madrid training camp or preseason this year a few pounds overweight. And he had a terrible start to the season, right, after his move from Chelsea. Mm. So your teammates would be saying, come on, man, what are you doing?
Big time.
Yeah. Banter.
Was it ever you guys?
It was good banter.
Were you guys ever out of shape when you got into camp?
Out of shape, but not overweight.
There wasn't one when you thought, man, I enjoyed the summer a bit too much.
No. No.
You let me down.
I enjoyed the summers, but not, not too much.
But you couldn't gain weight though, right?
No.
It's tough for you.
No, tough for me.
Both of you guys.
Yeah.
I mean,
me and Wonga here. Profile.
Johnny Hartson, but on West Ham United, he came back.
Yeah.
A stone. Overweight.
Big time. There was a lot of guys that came back. Like,
and it would set you back months.
It would set you back, and they would be doing extra training on top of the kind of running we were doing anyway. But going back to how things have changed now, nowadays you've got like blood tests, oxygen masks, you're hooked up to machines to discover like your VO2 max, which is basically your measurement of your maximum amount of oxygen, which you can do at an intense level. Mm-hmm. There was none of that back in our days. It was like, I remember vividly at QPR, my first couple of training, pre-season training sessions, we used to go to a place called Richmond Park. And you would plot it at the start of this entrance to the park, and you would run for around 2.5 to 3 hours of monotonous running in on a roadway, off track. It was just
like
so mind-boggling to me. And we had like Ian Holloway at the time, who was a player for us, who was obviously a captain everyone knows, was like the white Mo Farah. He just...
Was he?
It was just unbelievable.
Really?
And then you got like the big loggerheads at the back. Me as a young 17-year-old is expected to be up near the top. And it was funny, I had an apprentice at the time. We kind of veered off the pack, off the beaten track with a couple of us. And he said, listen, I know this park pretty well. There's a bus stop over here. If we can jump on that bus a couple of stops, we'd end up doing shaving off at least a mile of this. So I said, I'll have some of that, fella. So we jumped on the bus, and the conductor was there. It was the old school buses that had the open backs. And he's going, where are you two going? We said, we've lost our team. We're in the park somewhere. So he's going, well, have you got any money? So I said, no, we haven't got any money. So he said, well, you're going to have to get off. So we were, like, giving him bits of stick back. We said, we can't get off when the bus is going. So we had to get off at the next stop. But we still shaved off a quarter of a mile. Got back on 2.5 hours later. We arrived back at the finish line.
Yeah.
No, we weren't, because the coaching staff used to drop us off, go back to the training ground, have a cup of tea, some breakfast, and then come back 2 hours later to see who are the fellas that have broken down, who are the guys that have finished.
Yeah.
That's why I say I think it was more of a mental thing. You're getting your fitness, of course, but the monotonous run of just running around a big park was
it wasn't very creative.
No.
And I think they made it up as they went along.
But nowadays, as I said, with all the tests and stuff, you have strength and conditioning staff that are in. They can be as creative as you want. I think even Arsene Wenger came back and changed the mindset a little bit of coaches by saying, for me, there's no need to be doing monotonous running in pre-season or long distance running longer than 12 minutes. Your running has to be done intelligently.
Mm-hmm. And now, with the ball.
And with the ball. And now counter that to Klopp, who says, for me, the hardest working team that runs the most is going to be the most successful. So what is the balance?
The balance there, yeah.
Yeah.
You can do both, can't you?
You can do both, but I think, as I said, go back to the strength and conditioning guys that are now in place, and we've had Alex on, who's one of the top guys in his system. I feel that there's specific training that is going to help specific players. There's no point, Craig, running around Richmond Park for 3 hours, he's going to do more damage to his back or to a specific part
but
of his
leg. But an explosive type workout would be far
explosive, doing his weights, plyometrics, now, and stuff like that.
When you played, you blow up now, literally.
Yeah, blob, melting ice cream cone.
But now you get you give these kids kids their off season plans as well, right? Mm. They're given you must do this to get in shape. Back then, was it once the season finished, we'll see you in the summertime, or did they give you a program?
I mean, no, there was a program. And to be honest, I would keep myself at a certain level in off season. So I would make myself go for runs and things like that at least every other day for the few weeks you're off. You're not off for that long.
It's not long, is it? Yeah,
it's not
a good
long.
Point. Preseason is
sometimes you're
short.
And if you're with the national team at all, you might get 2-3 weeks maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe, and then you're right back in it. So,
did you ever get conflicting advice from your national team coaches compared to your professional team coaches
for preseason
for training in general?
No, because we were always, when we went into the national team, we're always in good shape.
Yes, it wasn't
playing
about
shape.
At that
point. It wasn't about fitness. It was just about doing what you could in the 5 days you're with the club.
But we ever told them, okay, Craig, you know, we think you need to work more on this part of your game, which contradicted what we told at West Ham or Ipswich.
Oh no. No, nobody in Canada would tell me what to do.
You were the man, right?
He was the man.
He has swagger. He was Craig Forrest, after all. Canada's only professional player.
But going back to preseason, most players really did dread like preseason, as me and Craig have attested to. But what I would say that there was a togetherness and team spirit that was built during preseason. Whether you were doing a long run, whether you were doing 1,000 push-ups, whatever it was, and you had those 2 or 3 hangers on, myself probably, that was struggling to get through it, and the team kind of rallied around you, and I feel that set you up really, Craig, for the season. Whether you had new players come in, older players trying to bring the young uns into the squad, and there was something about preseason that built that team spirit. That's what coaches, a lot of your coaching is done in preseason. But also your team spirit is kind of
built
within that.
Is that why
that
you should go away for hot weather training? Whatever it's going to be, it's partly because it's nice weather, but also because that getting away from home is going to build the morale of a team.
Well, you mean going away for preseason?
Yeah.
Well, it all depends on where you go.
Talkie wouldn't be quite the same as
worst place you've been to preseason, Craig. Let's get into the nuts and bolts of it.
The worst and the best is probably the same thing.
I like it.
Because worst, because you've got to, you know, we're in Sweden. Things are pretty good there.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we're young. Right?
What do you mean by that?
There's lots going on. And I remember us being in the bar and the coach came down and said, if you guys don't get out of here tomorrow, you're going to pay. You're going to pay.
You paid?
And we're like, oh yeah, we paid. We're like, we're not going anywhere. This is just too much fun. So the next day we paid. We were run until you puked, basically.
Yeah.
And we never went back to Sweden again for preseason. Went for postseason because it's more of a holiday, right? But preseason, you know, it was hard to control a bunch of young football players.
A lot of teams actually went to Scandinavia, but the teams I went with, like Sunderland, West Brom, Millwall, we went to Scandinavia, but remote parts of Scandinavia.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't only because you wanted to get the players away from any media or any attention which could cause damage to your actual team spirit that you're building, but also your fitness levels which you're trying to build up as well. It was to get away from the fans. But the big clubs that I played for, the fans would always find you in the most remote places as well.
Yeah. They'd follow you?
They'd follow it because it was a piss up for them as well.
Yeah, right.
And it actually caused more harm because they were closer to the field as well, where you were playing these preseason games, and you're literally where I'm standing now today in Wong, and the guy's telling you, "Dickio, fucking line up, you're fucking shite." So you're like,
and you're
only
northern,
2 weeks
northern
into preseason,
Finland, right? Yeah. You're northern Finland or something. Yeah.
Northern Finland, what's going on there? But those were tough times, but also good times because you could really focus on what you needed to do to try and get yourself up to par, ready for the start of the Premier League or wherever.
One thing that's not important was results because you could have the worst preseason, lose to non-league teams, and you know the media is all over. Like, where's this happening? What's happening? Yeah. And the season starts, and it's completely different.
There must have been times where, sure, you know, at your prime, you knew pretty much no matter what happens, I've got my job, I've got my shirt. Mm-hmm. There must have been times when you were fighting for a position though, and you knew you had to perform in preseason, wasn't there?
You know what? I think you're always fighting for your position, though. There's people coming up underneath you, these young bucks that are trying to take your position all the time. I think you can never rest on it. You know, it's a short career. You have to work really hard, focus on what you're doing, and these challenges are always there.
So you never felt comfortable?
No.
With the shirt?
Not overly. No.
It's always a competitive environment when you're playing in a professional football club.
Yeah.
You should never be comfortable.
Can you be tight with the guy who's looking over your shoulder? I want your shirt.
You knew the deal. I mean, it went without saying.
But it must be some players who thought, man, fuck off, Dickio.
Yeah, no, there was sure.
This is my shirt. Piss off.
Yeah.
But I'm a pretty good reader of people as well. So, like, I used to try and take the younger guys that were in my position as well and give them advice or just help them along the way. They would push me as well and keep me on my toes, but you'd also kind of read the certain players that had no interest in being a team player. They were in it for themselves, and they would, which is their way of doing things in life, but they would do anything to get your position and to hold on to that position, but which added to the spice, I think, as well, because you're not going to get on with every teammates. We played on a lot of teams where you probably got on with 25% of the team. There was probably two or three teams where we all got on together.
Who was your enemy, your biggest enemy, can you say? Is there one guy that you just did not get on with?
No, there wasn't really any guys, because I think once they started to understand what I was about and that I could give them advice and help them with their game as well, we slowly kind of built a mutual relationship where we'd get on for the best of the team.
But there must be certain teams, and there's a one guy just stands out, just doesn't really want to be there, isn't making the effort.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah. Must be frustrating.
It was mostly foreign players. No disrespect to Craig, but it was mostly foreign players.
I don't consider myself a foreigner.
He was
there.
An adopted British guy anyway.
Everyone else did, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, hold on a minute. Yeah. I was there 8 years before the Premier League started. Like, come on.
Yeah, I was going to say. Right? But, I mean, was there any particular pre-seasons where there was a huge turnover at the club and you arrived on day one and thought, holy crap, man, this is going to be a different beast this year?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh,
like,
sure.
You're like shaking hands. Hi, I'm Craig. Hi, I'm Danny. You're like numerous people.
New signings. I remember Harry Redknapp. We had a few new signings. Can't remember then. We had the team there the year before we finished fifth in the Premier League. And Harry's trying to get everybody going, saying that I think we can win the league this year. We're standing there, it's preseason, all grouped around, and Razor Ruddock, you can hear him in the back. So Harry's like, lads, I think we can fucking win the league. We can go one better, we can do it. And Neil Ruddock's in the background, he's like, ah. He started laughing. Harry Redknapp's like, who is that? Razor, was that you? That's your fucking problem, Razor. You got no belief. He's like, no, Harry, it's not about belief. He said, we need another six or seven in the squad. And we got no shit.
Did anyone believe? Apart from Harry? Did Harry believe, honestly?
I don't know if he did or not.
Yeah. He's trying to sell the
dream. If we had six or seven more...
Yeah.
A squad that size.
It's fifth. You finished fifth. You're West Ham. Holy crap, man.
That's if everybody stays healthy.
Yeah.
But then looking at Leicester, you know, all these years later, you know, you kind of, you know, you wonder whether that was more possible. But
there must have been years, too, when you looked around the room and thought, oh, God, this is going to be a long season.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. Every year.
especially when you've sold, like, your one or two good players, like your top players. I remember at Sunderland when we sold Kev Phillips, and he was a big miss to us as well. Even at QPR when I was younger.
You guys had a good partnership together.
Yeah.
Right?
And he was...
It's 30 goal year, wasn't
he? Got into England as well. He was scoring goals aplenty. And
he went to where? Southampton? Where did he go?
I can't remember.
Where did Super Kev go?
He went to either Villa or... No, I think he did go Southampton. It wasn't a bigger club as we thought he could go and play at anyway.
Right.
But there was plenty of times where you come back into pre-season and there was obviously a lot of press going on about this player's moving to here, this player's moving to there. So that was another reason for us to get out of the country, I think.
Southampton.
It was Southampton.
Villa after that.
Yeah.
Then West Brom, then Birmingham City, then Blackpool, then Palace, then Leicester. Jesus.
And a lot of clubs.
A lot of clubs, yeah.
Good player, though. Good player. But going back to, like, the places that we used to travel to, like, I went to some really nice places as well. Incidentally, I went with Millwall. We went to Vancouver one year. That was my first time in Canada.
That was the first time I met you.
Yeah.
Was it really?
Yeah. And we played against
Dennis
Hearts.
Dennis Wise, right?
Dennis Wise and Ray Wilkins.
Why Vancouver?
We'd just been in the FA Cup final. And the following year, I think we were invited by some Canadian businessmen to come over with Hearts as well from Scotland to play in a mini tournament against a select Canadian team.
Was Craig playing in that, right?
No. I don't think you didn't play in it, Craig.
No, because it was a Whitecaps, wasn't it? Or the 86ers?
No, it was a select team from Canada because we actually picked up Adrian Serioux and Josh Simpson from. Yeah. That select team.
From that select team. And Adrian became a bit of a legend there, didn't he?
Yeah.
It was a big long throw. Long throws. Yeah, they loved it.
It was like a missile. Yeah. They loved that down there in South London.
But you loved it.
My head didn't.
Yeah.
Well, but, it's a good weapon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good weapon.
But we had
forget about it. Can't drop a bag of cement. But friggin' hell, the guy could throw it 50 yards.
It became a point, wasn't it, Deech, where a throw felt like a corner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they're harder to defend. In the Stoke days, I think it was Rory Delap as well.
Yeah.
He had a massive throw from the halfway line. It was launched into the box.
Yeah. And you crowd the goalkeeper. Can't be offside on a throw-in. So they crowd the goalkeeper and lob it right in there, like throw it. It's a dangerous weapon that you can get something from.
Just remember Vancouver being like excruciating hot that year. So hot for us boys coming from London. We were like, this is like Tenko here, like unbelievable.
Tenko, that's a freaking obscure reference. That was about a Japanese woman's prisoner of war camp.
Yeah, but it was absolutely, that's what we call it.
I just found Tenko. Out something new.
Yeah, like 1985, dude, Jesus.
That's our way of saying Tenko. It was really hot. Tenko, it was absolutely Tenko there.
I was just going to ask, it was the first time you two met. What did you think of each other? You guys?
Oh, we didn't get into it that much. We shook hands and
I think you were part of the group that were trying to, I don't know, either bring football there or they were there was like a
I can't remember. I think
a group that was
Jerry
trying to
Dobson
set up friendlies
was there with me, but I can't remember why.
It wasn't televised or anything.
No,
it was just like a mini.
Maybe
tournament.
You were there doing stories then with sports
maybe.
Perhaps.
Maybe.
Yeah. Did you think then, Deech, man, I like Canada.
I loved Vancouver. I thought it was so, like, pretty, a lot different than South London where we were playing at the time. But we were training at, I think it was BC University, Craig, am I right? BC Lions was the...
BCIT.
It was a beautiful, setting, like, mountains in the background. Yeah. We were there for, like, 2 weeks, staying downtown in near Burnaby as well. So, really
good
time. That
was a postseason, right? Not pre.
Yeah. Preseason.
Was it
a preseason? Yeah.
Okay.
So we come a long way for that. But
yeah, no kidding.
I went, where else? With Sampdoria, we went to some crazy places as well. Sampdoria is obviously a big club. So we did our preseason in Genoa, which incidentally, at the time, only had two grass fields. One, Genoa, the football team, which is one of the longest standing football teams in Italy, is the oldest team. Mm-hmm. And one for Sampdoria.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe it. The rest were like either clay or dirt.
Jesus.
So we'd done our preseason there, which was a whole new way of training for me.
I was going to say, your first preseason in Italy.
Yeah.
Forget about
totally
club.
Different way of training as well, Craig, than just the monotonous running. It was very position specific. We did a lot of strength training to our legs, lots of bounding and jumping. But like really specific with this Argentinian strength guy that we had that Menotti brought in with him. And I probably felt the fittest that I ever felt in my whole career there. The amount of stretching that we did after the games, pre-training as well, was a real white eye-opener.
And that was
the
year when Sven signed you, and then by the time you got to camp, he'd left.
Yeah.
So what was your first conversation with the new manager like? Do you remember?
Not much, because he didn't speak English.
Right.
And his Italian was... My Italian was good, but his Italian was pretty poor, and the Spanish-Italian was you could understand bits of it, but he was obviously coming in, getting used to the new players as well. That was a big turnaround of players, but a hell of a squad we had there. But we went to Helsinki in Finland to play a friendly. We then went to Derby in England to open Pride Park, their new stadium. And then we finished in Barcelona, the new camp. So three friendlies in three totally different countries.
Hyde Park to Camp Nou.
Hyde Park to Camp Nou. Well, and Duguerry took us out. That's what I remember about it. Christophe Duguerry.
You're Sampdoria?
He was at Barcelona at the time, but we had a couple of French players, and he took us out that night in Barca. I just remember, I'm here with a World Cup winner. We're getting out. And I'm like 20 years old.
Were you a bit starstruck?
Very starstruck.
Yeah, really. Can I say, was there a moment in any of your careers when you were like, holy crap, I can't believe I'm in the same field as this guy? Was there ever a point?
Mm. Yeah, lots of times. Yeah.
Such as?
Romario.
Mm.
Romario.
Babeto. Against the Brazilians. Great.
Yeah, the Brazilian World Cup team, a month before they won
After you won Gold Cup?
No, this was 1994, a month before the World Cup started.
Okay.
So Brazil had their full team. Some team.
Wow.
Yeah. There was hundreds of Brazilian media in Edmonton, and after the game we drew, could have won it in the end, they were just crying out for everybody to be replaced. Manager, players, you know what it's, you know, you can imagine, right? Brazil. Yeah. And then a month later, they won the World Cup or so.
Jesus.
Yeah.
So that was a big
But anybody, any of those types of guys like Klinsmann and Shearer and any of the top players were always it was special to play against them. Mm-hmm. But nervous, of course, yeah.
Exciting. Was there a moment when you realized when you were a young kid, QPR thing?
Playing against players or
either
playing
one.
With them?
Either one.
I can't really, like... No, like I played against the Manchester Uniteds and the Liverpools of the day that were classics. I think a real eye opener for me was playing against Wimbledon, the crazy gang.
Oh yeah,
where you're in the tunnel, like, and they're basically bullying you in the tunnel. Fashanu, Vinnie Jones, Wisey, who I played under Sanchez. Back in the day, Sanchez, and these were like land of the giants, and I'm this like 18, 19 year old kid,
tiny, 6 foot two at that point,
and they're going out there talking, "Oh, hi, baby, how are you? You gonna have a nice game? You're the first one we're gonna launch right into the stand," and I'm looking for a bit of backup here for my captain.
And everyone's
just cowering like that. So that was my real, and I stood in like tunnels with like Schmeichels and Steve Bruce's and the Pallisters, or even the Liverpool team back in the day, like the Johnny Barnes, all them guys that I grew up watching, legends. But that was the crazy game was a real eye-opener for me, going, oh shit.
Yeah, no, it's true.
This is going to kick off big time here.
Yeah.
Did it, but I loved it.
Did it affect your play, or did you like?
No, not really.
It pushed you forward.
It pushed me forward.
That'd be right down Dicchio's alley.
Yeah,
that
was right. That
exactly.
was right.
Let's be honest.
Probably give me my grounding tools
and his mullet.
And my mullet.
His mullet stood on its own. It was his best partner out there.
Did you used to flick it? Do you used to flick your hair? Like,
no, I used to have
Fabio?
Really
You're
long
like Fabio.
Hair. I had a ponytail. I had really long hair.
Of course, he had a ponytail.
I think you should go there again. You should go the ponytail again. Have that the bald and then the ponytail.
Yeah,
yeah.
Who's that actor that you? He was an actor that used to act the hard man in films. Oh.
You look like Hulk Hogan.
He had long hair like on the sides here, and he used to tie it back, but big
ball. Seagal.
Oh, yeah. Seagal. Seagal. That's right.
Steve Seagal.
What are you talking about?
Actually, you look a little like Steve Seagal. Seagal.
Great it's movies, true. By the way.
That's a good Halloween.
The one, the movie on the ship was kind of the end of it, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, remember finished him.
Yeah, it did.
No one's heard of him since.
Under Siege.
Under Siege, yeah, exactly. Under Siege. Wow, what a movie.
But going back to pre-season, what time, Craig, because this is interesting for me as well, what time or week did you start to feel like, okay, I'm feeling sharp, I'm ready now? Because it took me a long time to
get... What part of the week?
No, like, you know, we'd start probably early July. Would it take you a week? Would it take you 2 weeks?
Oh, before you feel...
Yeah, because like the first week, you're basically, your muscles, your body is broken down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is only with a few weeks off. It should be like...
Yeah, this is like 3-4 weeks off.
That's it.
Yeah. But
I've got 10 years right now, I haven't done nothing.
And then you're back at it, right?
But you had been moonwalking in Tenerife for those whole 3 weeks.
Oh, yes.
And doing the Billie Jean dance.
Yeah.
Or in a lounger in Magaluf.
Sinatra's in Magaluf, was it? No, Sinatra's was in Puerto Banús.
Marbella.
Yeah. Oh,
Jesus.
Yeah, a few teams went there.
but you think about nowadays, so like I'm going back to the goalkeepers, for a 90-minute game, the average footballer runs anywhere between 8 and 13 kilometres in a game. Midfielders, obviously, are the highest because they're running box-to-box. Forwards are the next. Defenders are the next laziest fuckers. But goalkeepers, on average, still run between 4 and 6 kilometres per game.
Really?
Just which baffles me.
Staying warm?
Yeah.
That's like, amazing.
I can't see Edison running 4 to 6 kilometres per game.
Actually.
He's just like that, hanging on the post, smoking a cigar. Yeah. But it's interesting. Like, I was looking at the stats in this gun. How does a keeper run
doing,
between
Greg?
4 and 6 kilometres?
Well, I mean, I always kept to keep in the game. I always had certain things where I'd run box to box, like point of the box to point of the box. I would do that on every corner that we had. So it's just different routines, but
just
always
stay warm.
Keeping... Yeah, warm for that moment, you know, like if you're going, you might be there for not many of my teams where I was there half an hour without doing anything, but you could go long spells without doing anything and then have to show up with something big. So you better keep yourself
in the game. Was there a point, like Danny mentioned, was there a point though in preseason where you thought, okay, now I'm ready, now I'm switched on, I'm good to go?
Yeah, it didn't take very long. I mean, most of it was, you know, just getting your eyes in, you know, being able to see your vision on picking up flights, the balls for corners and things like that. Just because
so you would lose that quickly, would you, after the season?
Yeah, you lose that. That's why it's important, I think, for certain goalkeepers can play well if they're playing regularly, and then you have some goalkeepers that can go months and months on the bench, not play, and go in and do well, and then some of them can't do that. They need to play all the time.
Did you have a vision coach? I know nowadays a lot of teams have those for... The focus on depth. That's why you see in hockey, you see the guys juggling tennis balls and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff you do was reactionary stuff like that. If you're facing a wall with your back to your coach or somebody who's going to distribute the ball off the wall in front of you, so you have to react. So
wool ball.
Just everything was just reactionary, trying to pick up just fast.
Yeah.
You know, really, really quick. Always had good goalkeeper coaches, though, and even back in when before. It's more specific, but, you know, legendary guys, I knew what they were doing. You know, Phil Parks, Les Seeley, Luke McClosco, you know, excellent, brilliant goalkeepers that had a real eye for it.
Did it help that you knew they played the game at a high level?
But there was one guy called Malcolm Webster who had played at Cambridge for years but never got above sort of third tier. He was probably the best goalkeeper coach I ever had.
Oh, yeah?
So a guy that never made it at the top end. But just his ideas and his angles and how he had you diving in certain ways that were... He was basically under the impression that we can save... And from certain spots, it's unsavable, but there's other places where you can be and save shots that are going in the top corner if your positioning is right and you dive in the right positioning, not diving back, you're diving forward or diagonal. So he had the best sort of way to put it that way and was the best coach... from that standpoint, very good with young kids, better than the top-end goalkeepers who naturally picked it up. Like Les Seeley, if a kid came to the ground trying out and he was 14, 15, and you'd bang a couple balls at him right at his nose, and if he can't catch it, he was like, well, what are you doing here? Like, he was blatantly audio. Like, he was like, I'm going to be honest with you, kid, you can't catch a ball. Yeah. I don't know if you can kick or take a cross or take, you know, or just your distribution. You can't catch a ball, so what are you doing here?
It's like, same broken hearts, same broken noses.
Oh, yeah, Les would break some hearts.
But going back to the training, which Craig is speaking about now, there's so much cognitive training that goes into the actual specific training now, specifically for goalkeepers. Even for players now, they're using all these lights and different reaction software that they can use within the training grounds or even on the field. So the goalkeeping training has gone up to a new level now where it's not only just about handling or, as we've spoken about before, in possession of the ball. It's like the reaction, your senses, your memories, stuff like that, which is
But players, I'm sure, now are more open to that as well, right?
I'm sure
back in us, maybe before you guys played.
Well, when we were still playing, the GPS and the heart rate monitors were just coming in.
Right.
And we had these bands around us that used to drive me crazy because I didn't like to wear anything under my jersey. So we had these bands that were very uncomfortable. And as I said, the game has evolved. An interesting story, actually, from back in the day. We used to have these heart rate monitors or GPS on us for our rest weekends as well. So if we had a weekend off, but we was given a specific program to have that weekend off, the coach would say, or the strength and conditioning guy would say, listen, we're giving you these 2 days off, but you have to do some light to medium work. So we'd wear them. fucking Don Hutchinson didn't do anything all weekend. He took his dog to the park and put the GPS on his dog. The GPS and the heart rate monitor.
I did something similar once. I did that. Me and the missus got Fitbits years ago, right? And we had a bit of a contest, you know, who could get the most kilometers. I put it on my dog and went for a run. playing fetch.
And it recorded it. It was perfect.
Oh, yeah.
Jeez.
Listen, the staff came back in on Monday. Don handed his GPS and his heart rate monitor back in, and he got called back into the room again. What the have you been doing?
300.
On Sunday, your heart rate monitor has gone up to like...
300?
So what if you were in, let's just say you're in Sweden on pre-season, had an off day, and they said, you got to wear this. Might be an issue.
Wouldn't be doing too much
what
in the bar.
What were you doing? Very short spurts for some reason. It wasn't long, but my God, the heart was going.
30-second bursts. Or 1 30-second burst.
Yeah, exactly. God. But it must, I mean, at first, as youngsters, you must have been raring to get at it. I mean, your first professional contract, I'm going to show these guys, right? At what point did you realize, nah, I just don't enjoy preseason? Was there a point?
From my first preseason.
Oh, from the first one.
It was the first one.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we done preseasons as youth team players as well, so you knew what it was about. It was just more intense when you hit the first team because you're not actually playing or training with guys your own age like you would in the youth team. You're now competing with older guys, experienced guys that have been through many preseasons.
Mm-hmm.
So they're stronger, they're quicker, and you're having to kind of compete with them. I go back to even when I speak to our younger boys that are going to train with the first team or even guys that I played with back in England and said, the head coach is not even looking at you at the moment. You are just a number. You're a training number. So make sure at every opportunity you work your absolute socks off. And that if you're called upon, you can show that you can play at this level, you can compete at this level. But in no way think about you can just play on the peripheral of this training session and get by.
Because
when you do get your chance, if you get your chance, and most don't, you better make it count. You really have to make it count.
Small window opportunity, right?
You might get out one training session, two training sessions.
Did you, with the players that you thought he's going to make it for sure, great talent, has first... training camp, has a bad session, doesn't get looking, and his career wasted? Can it happen?
Lots of talent. There's various reasons why people will fail. They could have all the talent in the world. They might not have the mentality to be able to stick it out too, and deal with it, deal with what's happening off the field, all these different things that surround you.
Getting up for preseason games? I mean, I know myself playing sports, in my life, I hated preseason because I couldn't switch on for a preseason game. Playing rugby, for example, right? Once the real game started, that's no problem at all. But preseason, I just couldn't get in 100%, and that's when you get hurt, of course. Were you able to, okay, it's freaking first preseason game of the year, I'm going to give 100%, the same as I would in the last game of the season?
As a goalkeeper, you're just trying to, again, use it as a practice, out players and...
Would you go for 2 feet on a tackle, for example, or would you pull out of a tackle in preseason that you wouldn't?
Well, your game, especially your first 2 or 3 games, are all managed by the sports science group. So you'll see certain players will only play 45 minutes for the first game.
Right.
And then the next game, your top players will play 45 or 60. So it's a gradual transition to getting up to those 90 minutes. Your loads, your GPS, everything's measured. And put in a specific individual program for you so that your build-up towards the end of preseason is measured towards you starting that first league game. But for me, preseason games, especially as a striker, was about getting your confidence as well as your fitness.
Right.
So getting reps in and around goal, trying to get shots, trying to get efforts, trying to bang 3 or 4 goals in that preseason so it transitions into the league season where you're kind of playing on the front foot. So I always use preseason as a good starting block for me to kind of get that confidence. Whether you were playing against lower league teams, teams from the Premier League, when you were in the Championship, for whatever reason, obviously it wasn't a league game or competitive game in that sense, but you were still playing for a spot. You were still trying to play to help you, to guide you into that first league game of the season. Because they, when you start in August, you know those games come pretty quick and fast because you have the League Cup coming in that month as well.
Yeah. So it always depends, too, if there's a champ manager change, too, and whether you have to impress or whether that manager always knows you or whether that manager likes you. That all comes into play as well.
The other thing I was always thinking about was, and it's Let's Talk Mental Health Week, I think, right?
Is it this week?
I think it's either this week or next week. Mm-hmm. But has professional footy moved into a place where they have mental health professionals? Because I can imagine the stress for a new player. You know, like, I can't imagine a 16-year-old from fucking Burnaby or Coquitlam or where it is. Yeah. You fly over there. And they go, oh yeah, you're on a training team now. Go for it. You know, and like there's this level of, you just talked about lost talent because of stress, anxiety, all kinds of different things, and not performing. Have these professional teams moved into a place where mental health is
That's a
now...
good question. I don't think they've moved as far. I was experiencing over there with one of the players at West Ham who lived in the Ipswich area, Richard Hall. He was 27 when he had a career-ending injury. I mean, he was at West Ham for 2 or 3 years with this foot injury, trying to get through it, but couldn't. And his career was, you know, going up very, very quickly. He moved from Southampton to West Ham. Some people say he was almost single-handedly saved West Ham in the Premier League that year. So his career was going places. They're talking about him being England captain at center back, and then all of a sudden this happens. He spiraled it out of control, and mentally he went... in a deep, deep place, a dark place. He ended up the Priory, the hospital, the mental hospital in London, which is, he was fortunate enough that that somebody paid that for him, but it was hugely expensive. So, you know, not the average person could go to it. He was able to go to it and got through it, but there's all that as well that comes into a play too. As a kid that's, you know, been good since they were 5, 6, you know, all the way through their life, that's been, and they've been pampered, and you're building things up, and when it all comes crashing down, those type of things come into play.
Well, I always thought, you know, as an athlete, overachieving is easy. You know, being an overachiever, he's too small to play. You play with a chip on your shoulder all the time, and wherever you're from. But even with Ditch, and you're like, you had some injuries and you had concussions. Were the teams, you know, talking about that back then?
No.
You know? No.
Not at all.
Concussions, not at all. Roll you right back out there. Yeah. It's a little bit like, you know, Trump made a comment about the, you know, the bombing when Iran threw some bombs over at the base. Said there was no injuries, or there's a couple of head injuries.
34 now.
Yeah. Apparently just some head injuries.
Yeah.
You know.
Which so they'll be dealing with
The respect for mental health has still got a long way to go.
Well, your kids teach at TFC. I mean, I'm assuming you keep a close eye on that side of things now compared to when you were at that point
100%,
in your career.
Yeah, because you're putting these young boys in an environment now where they're probably being pressured from the parents to stay within the academy, whether it be at Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, or any academy around the world. So there's a huge amount of pressure on these younger players compared to when we were younger players. We were playing for the love of it, and there wasn't as much pressure from the parents, whether it be from the sidelines, whether it be in the car on the way home, to say, why didn't you perform to this standard? I just feel that this modern generation are not only under so much pressure from their peers, but also from their friends now on social media and certain platforms like that, where whether you're in a high-level hockey team, a youth level, baseball, basketball, you're like the big shot. So you have to perform day in, day out. You have to act with a certain amount of swagger as well, because you're the jock at the school. Or
do you have any kids that you think at your academy that don't want to be there? They don't believe in themselves enough, but their parents are pushing them that they want them to do there?
Yes, 100%.
How do you deal with that? Because
we have player coach meetings every 2 or 3 months. And then there's certain times when I'll pull the player to the side, or I'll just have a general conversation with him, kind of a casual conversation to see how he's doing. But I always, as I said, I'm a pretty good people reader, and I get the sense from a young player that he's not interacting with the group or he's just not in it. And I've got a player in my team now that I kind of think to myself, why do you come every day? Like, you look like you don't want to be here. And I don't know whether there's certain stuff going on at home. He's trying to go to university. So I just have to try and give him as much support as possible and try and make him feel a part of the squad and the team as much as possible, because he doesn't play week in, week out. And there's certain other players within the academy as well that I've spoken to and said, and in front of their parents, and said, it really doesn't look like you want to be here. Like, when you're in this environment, you're being given an opportunity to progress to either our professional ranks or the pathway of going to a high-level university. Mm-hmm. So grasp that opportunity. But a lot of these young boys are going through certain stuff, whether it be at school, whether it be in their social life, that we don't see every day. So we have the analogy of saying, try and be aware of what is in that player, that child's backpack, because there's a lot of stuff in there that we do not know about and we don't see every day. So it's very hard for us to put on sessions as well as manage the everyday behaviours and how their emotions are every day. But I look at that very, very deeply. I really do. Even more than the tactics every day of a session, I look at the actual body language and how players are interacting with each other, and I can see straight away if someone's down, and I'll try and bring them into the group with a little bit of humor, or it might even be that they just need to sit down with me on the side.
So much different than being a player, eh? Because now you're being a coach, and as well as young players, just dealing with what are they dealing with off the field?
Yeah. Do they have a
relationship with their parents, with their siblings, friends, the pressures of friends?
Tough. It is tough.
It must be so difficult, though, for a footballer, be it in pre-season, a youngster, who comes to that point of self-reflection, introspection, when he realises, man, I'm just not good enough. Mm. I'm not going to make it. You, as a coach, have probably seen that way before the player does. How difficult is it then for the player to admit, okay, you know what, I'm going to have to go a different direction here?
It's a lot easier for my age group, because they're like 18 and 19, Charm. So they've come to a stage probably where they've been at our academy for a long, long time, and they probably haven't been playing as much as they expected within the last 6 months. So kind of the writing's on the wall. So I think it's a process where they can come to terms with it, rather than a 13, 14-year-old where he's been the top player at his youth club and he's come into our academy, and we always give them a year at least to try and transition into our environment, which is a difficult environment. It's a competitive environment where they're playing with all the best players that we've either scouted or we've developed through our academy. So there's a lot of players that have been very, very good players at their club, and they're now coming to our environment and playing with the rest of the good players from out the GTA, and they suddenly go, oh, I'm not as good as I thought I was, or I'm not as good as what my mum and dad tell me week in, week out, or my friends tell me week in, week out. So that's a huge stumbling block for a lot of our younger players, that we have to try and help and kind of groom them in a sense to believe that they are good enough to stay at that standard. But there's a lot of kids that fall by the wayside.
In the corporate world, managers will have workshops to how to fire someone, do it the right way. Mm. Do you have a way that you fire a player?
Well, it's different because we're not firing a young player.
But letting them know, okay, road ends now.
We'll bring the parents in. We'll do it in a face-to-face meeting. What we also do, which I think is a great thing that the club and what we do as an academy, we will also keep ties with that player. So we will send him to a club in his area that we have a connection with, that we have a relationship with, where we can keep an eye on that player and bring him back in 6 months to see if there's been any improvement.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not just a cut-off. Yeah, it's not just
a cut-off. So a guy like one of your young players who was doing quite well, he's had some injury problems, Josh Moreira, he recently took the university route and went down to Florida, I believe. He's enjoying
Jacksonville.
Yeah, he's enjoying it, by the way. Do you keep an eye on him?
For sure.
Yeah.
So we'll get all the games sent. We'll be in contact with his head coach, who's a really good guy. He came up to Toronto. Right. And I'll be in contact with Josh as well to see how things are going. Text him once the season's gone. And he'll come back in. So when they get a break in university, all our university boys have the option to come back in to use our gym or to train with my 19s team.
Really?
That's spring break or in the summer as well.
So once you're in, you're in.
Yeah.
In whatever capacity.
You're part of the family.
Yeah, you're part of the family, yeah.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And then the flip
until
side,
you're
of course,
not.
Until you're not, yeah. We know that feeling, don't we, Greg?
Yeah, sorry.
Sports, get out. Yeah. You get out. Yeah.
We're not bitter. We're not bitter.
But on the flip side, Deitch, then we see this past week, right? It's a good week. You get some of your players signing their papers for
TFC.
And that must, as a coach, make you very proud. But, I mean, for those players, I mean, my God, how do you prepare them? Okay, boy, you know, you've done great. You've signed your contract. It's going to change now, though. Do you prepare them specifically?
Well, ask Craig. He was a young player back in the day that offered a professional contract pretty soon after going over the pond. So
mm-hmm. You got a trial. Was that a trial first you got, right, when you went there?
Yeah, it was a trial first. I was there for a month, and then I had some backup plans to go to West Brom or Dundee United.
Thank God. You've been to Dundee. You never know.
Yeah. Thank God. Eh? It was last resort.
That is the last resort, by the way.
You keep working your way down. I mean, Ipswich.
No disrespect to Dundee. But...
Well, plenty of disrespect, actually. Let's be honest here. Jesus.
That's not a whole line, right? No disrespect, but Dundee.
I was just kidding, you know, when I called you fat. Like, no, still hurting.
Yeah. I mean, Ipswich should be that team now, actually. I'd probably rather go to Dundee than Ipswich. Freaking third tier, but...
Do you remember that day, though, when they said, okay, we want you to stick around?
They want me to stick around? Oh, yeah. They were kind of fumbling around for a while because they promised before I went there that they wouldn't sign another goalkeeper until they had a look at me, but they did. So to have me signed on as well.
And Peter Schmeichel went nowhere anyway. So
that's right.
They made the right choice. Yeah. No, I'm joking.
So when I did sign professional forms, again, you're super young and then you're expected. Like you all of a sudden feel like you have to be doing things out of the ordinary because now you're a pro.
Yeah, right.
So I think I came for the first couple crosses that were 30 yards out.
A little bit up.
Yeah, trying to do everything and not even close. And the coach is like, what are you doing? Like just keep doing what you're doing. Don't try to, like, I was trying to literally be Superman.
Ink dried on his contract?
Yeah. But that's got to be a big challenge, right?
Yeah, exactly. All 25 pounds a week of it.
It's got to be a big challenge, though, right? Just keep doing what you're doing. No, but I'm a professional now.
Yeah, now I'm a professional.
I've got to be doing more.
Yes.
No.
I thought I needed to be doing more.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. And be your first?
I mean, as a goalkeeper, too. I mean, it's a different position than, like, being a striker, for instance. Deitch has got to go out there and make things happen, right? Mm-hmm. Got to get involved. Got to get on the end of crosses. Got to make stuff happen. For goalkeepers, it's the opposite. You have to let things happen. You can't affect the other end of the field. You can only affect what's sort of in front of you. So mentally, you have to get their head around that. That you just can't, like, I was trying to make things happen. Well, you can't. You got to let it happen. You got to let it come, and you can only do what you can do, your job that way. So it took a long time to sort of appreciate that. And I think the goalkeeper position is why, you know, you're not, I would say that you're in your mid-30s or early 30s when you're peaking. 32, I thought I was probably at my very best. And I was told that when I was younger, that it would probably be the case from other goalkeepers. And truly was, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, even if you lose a little bit of, you know, your reflection or your reflexes are off a little bit, but what your knowledge of the game and your comfort
football
zone,
football IQ is at all-time
your
high.
Football IQ, your physical literacy, everything is at peak. So you're in a good spot.
Was it hard for your folks to say, okay, you know what, stay there, Craig? Now you're English.
Well, my folks, my dad and my mom was completely different because my dad was not only my mom wasn't supportive, she was, but she was also. You know, for moms to lose a teenager, and you're going over there, and there was no Skype or, you know, it was a dollar a minute back in the 1980s, phoning. So it was a big adjustment for them. But my dad was, you know, pushing and
have fun, son.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. Have fun. Yeah.
Yeah. And what you, Deitch? I mean, your first professional contract. You know, you've been playing age groups. You know, it's different for you, right? Because you're in the football system your whole life.
Yeah.
Whereas Craig got into it quite late. This was just a progression, right? Was it still a big moment?
Yeah, I think it was an achievement. But I'd grown up at QPR since I was 9 years old. Yeah. I was scouted at 9. So I'd come through all the system.
5'11"
5'11" with a moustache at night.
Dude, just actually 60 right now.
I'm not doubting that. I'm not doubting that. When did you have a beard?
12.
Yeah.
I remember he was the guy that we sent to the liquor store, right?
Yeah. I mean, I remember, there was a guy on the BC Select team back in the day. I mean, if you're 15 and you can have a beard... You have a beard.
Yeah.
So he's in the team photos, and you can imagine, like, he was the guy you sent for the liquor, right?
Yeah.
Because he looked like he was mid-20s.
He's McLovin. He's our McLovin.
Yeah. Did he go through the bum fluff stage, or was it just, you know, coarse beard straight away?
Yeah, no. Real bum fluff. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Because once you shave like that? That's it. The coarse stuff is coming through
there, right? Yeah.
Is it itchy yet?
No, I've gone through the itchy stage now.
It's a lovely beard.
Yeah. Thanks. But no, I'd gone through the system from 9... all the way up to 17 when they offered me a professional contract after finishing my YTS, 2 years of YTS, which was
youth training experience. For those that don't know what it is.
Which Craig obviously went through, I went through.
How much a week were you getting paid in the YTS?
35.
35 quid a week.
So I was $10 more than...
Yeah, I was 25.
£10 more than...
25 Craig. Pounds a week.
And my landlady... Cheap foreign help.
Yeah.
Did you have small hands?
Yeah.
Little things?
No, it was child labor. It really was.
Yeah, we were put to labor as well.
Because we cleaned the stadium, we cleaned the boots, we cleaned the toilets, and they're like, oh yeah, so they got every bit of 25 pounds a week out of you.
Right.
And the landlady got 35.
Yeah.
But she had to feed you with that.
Right.
And that wasn't really food, was it?
No.
What was yours?
Mashed potatoes, 57 days straight.
And what was the name again? You had a name for it, didn't you?
Or Mrs. Bond.
Mrs. Bond.
Well, it was Mrs. Bond, yeah. The Dew Drop Inn.
The Dew Drop Inn.
Because Frank Yallop was around the house. came around Canadian International, been in Ipswich for a few years. Came around for mashed potatoes.
57 days straight mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
Wow.
I remember I was counting it. And then, and then I was sitting there at the dinner table with Frank, and Mrs. Bond's making mashed potatoes. And he looks at me and he's like, look over your shoulder. Look over your shoulder. I look over there. And I'm like, holy shit. She's mashing potatoes and she's got this big dewdrop hanging off her nose. And I'm like, oh, jeez.
That's why it was so creamy, though, the mashed potatoes.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is it. So me and Frank, I'm looking at Frank going, oh, come on. And then he's like, no, look again. So I turn around and look again. And now the dewdrop's gone and she's mashing the potatoes.
Oh, God. Now, what day after 57 was this?
Oh, probably about 33, something like that.
So you got you thinking for a 4 days.
Yeah, Frank's
straight.
Like, oh, no, Miss Bond, by the way, no mashed potatoes for me.
And that's how you got the name.
Craig will have double.
The dew drop in, yeah. Frankie Nader, he goes, yeah.
Going back to the topic, preseason. So as an apprentice, preseason was one of the worst times because not only were you having to do your physical training, you were having to do all the jobs entailed as part of the YTS. So that was obviously all the first team equipment and
washing
the changing room, the toilets. I remember going into the first team room at times and the first team players would just throw their underpants on the floor and there was all kinds of disgusting colours in them underpants and you would pick them up like this and if we had like certain players that didn't like, we'd throw them on their heads and we had good banter as YTS guys, but like from cleaning the head coach's car, toilets. The stadium,
just it was taking a advantage
horrible
of
time.
Completely.
It was child labor.
Now it was child labor, but on the other hand, it certainly was. It kind of put you in your place because you hadn't made it yet. Put you in your place there. It gave you some discipline, and when you were released, which most players would be, at least they had that. Now they don't have to do it. They don't have to do any of that because it's not part of their job. Now, I get that because it was sort of cheap labor, but these kids all think they've made it until they haven't. And then when they leave, then they're lacking a little bit of discipline as well. Mm-hmm. And it puts them in a bad place when they're moving forward. So I'm not sure what's the best.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. I mean, we could go on a long time about that. What's best for kids nowadays, et cetera, et cetera. Probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe they get a bit too much too soon.
Definitely not 10 grand a week when you haven't made a professional
you pull up in your Bentley
appearance.
And you haven't got a first team appearance yet. Yeah, Jesus. Yeah. For the record, though, I only come here because my dad makes me. Don't you quit, son.
Wasn't it your dad that used to put you on the opposite team in
rugby? Yeah, he was,
when they had players
when they
there.
Were, when they were short, yeah. Rugby, in his coaching year. Team was short, a player.
Aww.
All right, you're playing for them today, son. Like, come on! Really? I know I'm no great shakes, no, but... And I just let guys run right past me and make no effort whatsoever. Yeah, so thanks, Dad. Still in therapy for that one.
Still in therapy.
All right, we're out of time. Craig, you're away next week.
Yeah, going to Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. Well, unlike myself, when Craig goes away,
scouting for Deitch, going to find some Mexican talent.
Footballers?
Yeah.
Huh? Footballers?
Golfers.
Yes. Is there any other talent?
Well, Sweden preseason camps would suggest there's plenty of talent elsewhere.
Yes.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that, everyone. Make sure you follow us. Please follow us on footy_prime on Twitter and on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube, Footy Prime, the podcast. That was a fun one, fellas.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
We shall return next week. Cheers for listening.
What up, Primers? JC here. Can't get enough of Footy Prime, the podcast? Why not head over to Footy Prime's YouTube? Head to youtube.com/footyprime for exclusive video content. Then make your way over to wearefootyprime.com for all things Footy Prime, including our official gear from Admiral and our One Ball Gin from Nickel 9 Distillery. And make sure to follow and subscribe across all platforms, from Twitter to Instagram to Facebook to TikTok. Footy Prime has got you covered for all things footy. Thanks so much for listening, and back to the show.